Icarus is a new book by Brian Brivati about the Dubai-based Abraj Group, pioneers of private sector impact investment in emerging markets. They were changing, or on the brink of changing, the world of private equity, but then it all came crashing down. To reveal more about international business and the role of politics within it as well, a fascinating story. Delighted to welcome to the show Brian Brivati. Brian, good morning to you.
Morning, Gav.
Good to have you with us. Tell us a little bit about then this who and I hope I got his name correctly, who Arif Naqiv was.
So, I mean, you said politics, and that's the key to all this. Arif Naqiv,
thank you,
founded Abraj in Dubai, largest private equity firm working in emerging markets, and it was destroyed in what John Perkins called an economic hitman operation. Basically, that's where the US and other interests decide a company is vulnerable, and they exploit that vulnerability to take it down and take over its assets cheaply. The politics goes back to Pakistan, where Arif was from, and that's Karachi Electric, the largest electricity company in Karachi, which is the electricity company that supplies large ports along that coast. China is building a network of ports called the String of Pearls and wanted control of that electricity company. Naqvi wanted to sell Karachi Electric to the Chinese, and the Americans did not want that to happen.
I mean, the Americans did not want to happen. That was mainly, I think you argue, because of the change of leadership in the States that took place during this time.
Yes, I mean, the deal is announced in October 2016. Mr. Trump is elected in November. Largest donations in history from U.S. private equity companies. And we've seen in the last week, a guy called Tom Barrack, who owned Colony Capital, was arrested in the U.S. for being an agent of a foreign power. That foreign power was the United Arab Emirates. And interestingly, it was Colony Capital that, after Abraj was destroyed, picked up their Latin American fund for peanuts in the fire sale. So someone like Barrack doesn't work for a foreign power for a monthly fee. He works for a foreign power to pick up a $700 million private equity fund for a few million dollars. That's what happened. And we'll see more, I think, as more of these cases unfold, as the Trump administration turns into a largely a legal process, as its history is written, we're going to see many more of the mysteries around Abraj solved.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's almost, it's a job, a case of basically a corporate hitman, if you like. I mean, I can imagine when then President Trump came to power, a business which was based in Pakistan that had Chinese backing was ticking all his boxes with a string of pearls, must have put shudders through the US administration and to US businesses. Because if you've got Pakistan, who the US administration, that of US administration, basically regards as a hostile power, with China, which obviously, again, Trump's antipathy, we can put it mildly, towards China is well documented, then did he basically... Or was the door left open for, if you like, other corporates to go and have a crack, as it were?
Yeah, I think that's more or less right. I mean, I think Pakistan is hostile to the US and pro-China, but it's also got a strong pro-American lobby within it. So there's a conflict there. And it's that pro-American lobby that was able to slow and ultimately stop the sale of Karachi Electric, which meant that the money from that sale didn't go into Abraj as Arif Naqvi had expected, and that caused a cash flow crisis. That made it vulnerable. US private equity loved Abraj. Abraj had a network in all the emerging markets, all the growth economies of the future, Kenya, Nigeria, in Latin America, all over the world. It would have cost them $500 million to create that network. Ideally, then, if you could pick it up for a few million dollars, after the company came crashing down. And how do you do that? Well, you destroy the company's reputation and you destroy Arif Naqvi's reputation. So in my view, you leak material to the press, you either hack their server or you leak material from inside the company that makes people question the way the company was run. And once that happens in the private equity world, confidence disappears. And it's like a run on the bank then. And once you run on the bank, you can pick up the assets of that bank cheaply. And in my view, that's more or less what happened.
Tell me a little bit about the founder then, the man behind Abraaj Group. What was he like? Did he play the corporate game? What was his standing before this, if you like, campaign of corporate whispering took place?
Well, he's a fascinating character. I mean, exclusively, I've done extensive interviews with him. And what I found was a man, I mean, he's been broken by this now, but a man who was absolutely committed to the idea of impact investment, which is not a fairy tale. It's about mobilizing private capital to build the kind of public goods that were built in the West over hundreds of years, schools, education, to introduce clean energy, to invest in places that people in Western private equity companies didn't even know the names of these countries and cities. So he opened up this world. He was a regular at the World Economic Forum on multiple platforms, preaching this philosophy of using private money to try and alleviate poverty. Now, there's a huge critique of that whole process, but actually, in my view, fundamentally, if we're going to address world poverty, in the end, it's going to be private money which is going to do it successfully, because governments have failed, charity has failed. And I think he was on to something, and I think he believed in it passionately. But he was also, he was a Pakistani based in Dubai. He was a Pakistani based in New York, in London. And what he discovered, and I think this is very interesting for the expat community, what he discovered was when the chips were down, he reverted in everybody else's eyes to just being a Pakistani. As somebody said, Pakistanis are not our partners. They bring the tea. So when the crisis hit, it was suddenly revealed that he didn't have any great friends in Dubai. He didn't have many friends in London or New York. And his friends were back in Pakistan insofar as he had any. And he was eventually arrested at Heathrow Airport. And for the last 2.5 years or so, has been fighting extradition to the US under the UK-US extradition treaty. But we could have another whole conversation with the problems with that particular treaty, Giles. Maybe another day.
What was perhaps, it's an interesting one, isn't it? The fact that, you know, in business, you're supposed to build relationships. And yet when the proverbial hits the heating element, you know, these corporate types revert to their modus operandi. Oh, well, it's a little bit like when the Canadian sprinter, his name, won the Ben Johnson, the Olympic sprinter. When he won the gold medal, and Canada was all for him, and then when it found out he cheated, they actually said, "Well, actually, he was originally from the Caribbean." They can laud the achievements of people from different cultures and different business models, but when it all goes a little bit shaky, suddenly, you know, especially America, that whole WASP community bonds together.
Absolutely right, and I think that's the key. So I think that what he found was that when he was a technician making money for the Arabs loved him. When he was no longer useful for that purpose, or rather perhaps somebody like Tom Barrack, who had the ear of the President of the United States, was more useful, here's a pawn, and we'll give up our pawn because we're going for the king. And in the US private equity world, there is a ruthlessness. So while he was seen as one of them when he was a success, when he was building a company that had $14.6 billion under management, as soon as that disappeared, they were like, well, wait a minute, what can we pick up here? Because UK companies also picked up some funds on the cheap. And so I think you're right. It's not just the private equity world or the business world, you know. I mean, it is this. There is a veneer of cosmopolitanism where we're all global citizens, where globalization makes us all equal. And it is just a veneer. As soon as you cut through it, you go back to national identities. And these guys at Abraaj really, as I say in the book, they drank in the Kool-Aid of globalization. They really bought it. They didn't think they needed a nation state to look after them. And then when, as you say, things went wrong, then they suddenly discovered they didn't have, as the Russians say, a route. There was nowhere for them to turn to. And so they were completely exposed.
And I mean, how quickly did this turn around? I mean, you call it Icarus, obviously, after the mythical character who flies too close to the sun, only for the wax to melt his wings, and then he falls to his death. How quickly then did this all unravel? And what was the paper trail that led you then to this story of not only corporate politics but geopolitics?
So from 2002 till about 2016, Abrage was a successful, it wasn't stunningly successful, you know, it didn't make huge amounts of money every year. It had ups and downs, invested in about 200 companies, had 5 or 7, 8 flops. So it was it had good performance, not a stellar performance, but it was good. It was interesting in terms of where it invested and so on. 2016, Arif, after he'd had an illness, he decided what he wanted to do was take the company global, IPO it, list it, sell it, and then go into Pakistani politics full time. He was then a man in a hurry. And I think that's where his own failings in this come through. He rushed through a process of trying to turn this into a much bigger company so that he could exit. So from the middle of 2017 until the middle of 2018, that's the period in which the company basically collapsed. And I was actually writing a completely different book about another Greek term, stasis, to describe lockdown and the internal conflict in the world between populism and democracy. And I was doing it through writing individual stories, and I came across his story. And it struck me that the whole world was following Julius Raj's battle against extradition, and no one had noticed this guy. And so I started digging into it and getting interviews. And then a young Indian journalist, actually, working in the Gulf, sent me a bunch of material and said, look, I was going to do a book, but I'm never going to work again in the Gulf if I write a book on this. You have it. And in that, there was a lot of material. And then online, there's an astonishing amount of material, in particularly in that thing called the Wayback Machine, where you can search the internet any day, any week of the year. And I was then lucky in that I went to court, listened to the hearing against Mr. Naqvi, met his son, and his son said, look, send me what you've got. And I used to be a human rights professor. I'd written to his lawyers already. They'd refused to see me. But I think just something in the way I wrote to him was saying, I'm going to write an objective account. I'm not out to destroy you, your character, whatever. And so he gave me the interviews. There was a combination of the documents and the interviews. Everything I've found is being put slowly on a website so that everybody can read all the documents. And I think that's crucial in this whole case, that up to now, he has been completely silent because his lawyers have said, be silent. Whereas other people fighting extradition, you couldn't miss them giving interviews, writing books, and so on. So no one's heard the other side of this case up to now, only really the case of the prosecution, because where various Murdoch-controlled newspapers have been running DOJ press releases on the case over the last couple of years. So it comes a bit of a shock to people who followed the story that there is another side, but there is definitely two sides to this story. And I think in the end, I think he will face trial somewhere. And he made mistakes, but that should be a civil trial in the UK. And if he was a white banker in Goldman Sachs or Barclays Capital, that's exactly what would have happened to him, not this.
And you can argue the point as well, can't you? Because it just shows, I suppose. I mean, he backed the Dubai Art Fair, didn't he? For a decade, wasn't he? He was also involved in philanthropy, and then as you said before, and then he gets absolutely wiped out by the other investment firms. Who's picked up the pieces? Who's benefited the most then from the downfall of the Abrage Group?
So, I mean, the US benefited. They've blocked the sale of Karachi Electric to the Chinese. It's still not gone through. Original deal done October 2016. Karachi Electric is still owned by the Abrage Group, what's left of it in terms of liquidation process. So the US have gained. The Chinese have lost out in that sense. Their CPEC program in Pakistan has stalled. US private equity companies, including Colony Capital, which at the time was controlled by Tom Barrack, who I said had just been arrested as a foreign agent, picked up the Latin American business cheaply. Other private equity companies picked up the other funds cheaply. And this is a very important point, because every single investor in a Braj has either got their money back with interest, or their money is still invested, and when those investments are sold, they'll get their money back. NACV put together a restructuring package in August 2018 with a company called Houlihan Lokey, who are big experts in this restructuring world. If that had been accepted, all the creditors would have been paid back. So in a way, the charges by the DOJ are these guys were conspirators. Well, all their minutes of all their meetings and board meetings are available. They were fraudsters. Well, it's not quite clear what fraud they committed when all these agreements are governed by things called limited partner agreements. And they were thieves. Well, they're odd thieves, right? They paid back all the money that was supposedly taken with interest, and they proposed a way in which all their creditors would have been paid back as well. Now, I'm not saying Arif Naqvi is not a man with flaws, or that Abraj did not make mistakes. I'm sure there were mistakes made. But what I'm saying is what's happened is disproportionate to what was happening in that firm. And what I was intrigued by was why. Why, you know, was this nuclear weapon used against a tiny company? And as I've said, I think the answer in the end is geopolitics.
And the other thing, of course, is that if you do something, if you obliterate a business person like that, who presumably he had a following in Pakistan, presumably he was something of a local hero, if you like, or a national hero almost, because he was doing, you know, good works. There's a real possibility that people may think in those regions, well, we're not going to bother working with you guys in the future. You know, we're not going to bother dealing with the West because this is what you do to us. And that has implications on our relationships with both. And I'm not just talking about the West, I'm talking about Dubai and the Gulf states as well, because they're going to say, you know, especially the Gulf states, you've treated our working people, shall we say, in an interesting manner, and I use that word advisedly, but why should we bother getting involved with you when there is the next big thing, China, who are investing worldwide massively, from Africa to Latin America to the Caribbean. We're going to get involved with those guys and forget about the Gulf states and forget about the West.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, what you've got to think about is if the only way the US could compete with China in Pakistan was by blocking this kind of a deal at a micro level. In Africa, the US State Department offers a free service of reviewing every contract with China to point out potential debt implications of it, to try and discourage African countries from taking those investments. We're losing the fight. If that's the level at which, you know, we're fighting, that's bringing switchblades to a gunfight, and we're going to lose it. Secondly, I think what it does is expose the myth of globalization, right? You know, we've got to abandon this idea that there is a universal common good, a universal common practice based on the rule of law, which governs international business. It's dog eat dog. The Chinese have always known this. They've always practiced business in that way. And the US has woken up to it and has begun to fight back and begun to fight in these admittedly very dirty ways. So for every country involved in this, it's a wake-up moment. But for every CEO of every global company, it's also a wake-up moment. If your interests collide with the interests of the United States or the interests of China, you've got to be very careful because the gloves are off. And what's doable in terms of hacking, what's doable in terms of using the media to destroy reputations, is fine-tuned. We've just seen in the Pegasus leaks the extent to which our communication systems are completely impregnated with listening devices. So I think about what I'm writing about and talking about, and it sounds like a novel, right? It sounds like a thriller. But actually, all of this stuff is going on. And this is a cautionary tale for everybody involved in this world to be even more cautious than they were before and look at their risk metrics. Now, the problem with that is it suppresses global trade, right? In post-COVID, it's one of the things that's going to slow down potentially our recovery. So globalization was a wonderful idea, and it was a driver of economic growth for a long time. If it's over, there's a big cost to pay for that.
The book is called Icarus, The Life and Death of the Abrash Group. I could talk to you, Brian, about this for a lot longer, but I'm going to what we call crash the news in about 50 seconds or so. If people want to find out more about you or about Arif or all of that, where can they find you? Is there a website? Where can they get in touch with you and find out more?
So the website is abrashbook.com and the Twitter is at abrashbook.
The book is called Icarus, The Life and Death of the Abrash Group. It's by Brian Brivati. Brian, it's been an absolute eye-opener to speak to you today. Take care and stay safe.
Thank you very much for your time, guys.